Well, tonight we're looking at a big chunk, 1 Samuel 1 to 7, and I don't imagine most of you have read that right before coming. And so we'll read a part of it, but we won't read all of it, but enough to get it in front of us again. And if you don't mind, I'm going to ask your forbearance also. I've become accustomed when the covenant name of God appears in the text. Usually in our English versions, it's the Lord with Lord in all caps and so on, and that means that's the covenant name, the personal name of God. And I'm used to using Yahweh for that, Y-A-H-W-E-H. That's probably as close as we can get to the pronunciation. But it's the personal name of the God of the covenant in the Old Testament, and I'm accustomed to doing that. So that we don't have to teach an old dog new tricks. Let me just go ahead and do that so I don't have to catch myself. And if it's unfamiliar to you, you can translate it back to the Lord and so on in your own mind. So let's look and get the text in front of us a little bit. We'll just read a couple sections, but 1 Samuel 1, verses 1 to 20, and then we'll go on to a chunk of chapter 2. 1 Samuel 1, verses 1 to 20. Now there was a certain man from Ramathaim-Zophim from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, son of Jerochim, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zoph, an Ephrathite. And he had two wives, the name of the one Hannah, and the name of the second Peninnah. Now Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And that man went up from his town, from year to year, to worship and to sacrifice to Yahweh of hosts in Shiloh. And there were the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, as priests. Now the day came when Elkanah sacrificed, and he gave portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and her daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for Hannah was the one he loved, but Yahweh had closed her womb. And her adversary also viciously irritated her in order to upset her because Yahweh had closed her womb. And that's how it would go year after year, as often as she would go up to the house of Yahweh. That's how she would irritate her, so she would weep and not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why are you weeping, and why will you not eat, and why is your heart resentful? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? So Hannah got up after her eating in Shiloh and after drinking, and Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorposts of Yahweh's temple. But she, in bitterness of soul, prayed to Yahweh and wept and wept. And she vowed a vow and said, Yahweh of hosts, if you will surely look upon the affliction of your maidservant, and shall remember me, and not forget your maidservant, and shall give your maidservant a male seed, and I shall give him to Yahweh all the days of his life, then the razor will never go up upon his head. Hannah kept on praying before Yahweh, and Eli was watching her mouth. Now Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips were moving, but her voice could not be heard, and Eli took her to be drunk. So Eli said to her, How long are you going to be drunk? Get rid of your wine. Then Hannah answered and said, No, sir. I'm a woman with a fierce spirit, and I've not drunk wine or beer, but I've been pouring out my soul in Yahweh's presence. Don't count your maidservant as a wicked woman, for I've spoken all this time because of my huge complaint and irritation. Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your requests which you've asked of him. And she said, May your maidservant find grace in your eyes. Then the woman went her way, and she ate, and her face was no longer downcast. So they rose early in the morning and worshipped in Yahweh's presence. Then they returned and came to their home in Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and Yahweh remembered her. So it happened, as the days went by, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She called his name Samuel, for it was from Yahweh that I ask him. Now then, let's skip over to 1 Samuel chapter 2, and let's pick up in verse 11 and read through verse 26. This will give us a sense of what's going on at the worship center in Shiloh. 1 Samuel 2, verse 11. And Elkanah went back to Ramah to his house, and the lad was serving, that is Samuel, was serving Yahweh in the presence of Eli the priest. But the sons of Eli were wicked scoundrels. They did not know Yahweh. And here's the custom of the priests with the people. While any man was offering a sacrifice, a priest servant came along with, while the meat was boiling. He had a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he thrust it into the basin or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is how they operated in Shiloh toward all Israel that came there. What's more, before they burned the fat, the priest servant came and said to the man making the sacrifice, "Give the priest meat to roast, and he won't take boiled meat from you, but raw." When the man would say to him, "Let them burn the fat first, then take for yourself whatever you like," then he said to him, "No, but you must give it now, and if not, I shall take it by force." So the sin of the young men was very great before Yahweh, for the men treated the offering of Yahweh with contempt. Now Samuel was serving before Yahweh, a lad clothed with a linen ephod. And his mother used to make a small robe for him, and she brought it up to him year by year when she came up with her husband to offer the annual sacrifice. And Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife and said, "May Yahweh grant seed to you from this woman in place of what she requested of Yahweh." And they went to their place. Indeed, Yahweh did visit Hannah, and she became pregnant and gave birth to three sons and two daughters. Now the lad Samuel grew in Yahweh's presence. Now Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel, including how they slept with the women serving at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And he said to them, "Why are you doing such things, so that I keep hearing of your evil deeds from all these people? No, my sons, indeed, the report I keep hearing is not good. The report the people of Yahweh keep spreading around. If a man sins against a man, then God may mediate for him. But if it's against Yahweh a man sins, who can intercede for him?" But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for Yahweh had decided to put them to death. Now the lad Samuel went on growing and having favor both with Yahweh and with men. Well, that gets us a little ways into this account. Gray days in the kingdom of God, trying to swallow 1 Samuel chapters 1 to 7 at a chunk. Now, some people just have trouble on top of trouble. It was that way for Bobo Newsom, who was a pitcher for various major league clubs back about 1930s and 1940s. Bobo was had an offer from the Chicago Cubs to come pitch for them, so he got in his car in South Carolina, and as he was driving through the Smoky Mountains, he ran off the road, dropped 225 feet, came up with a broken leg, so he had to go back home. And while he healed, and he was about recovered, so he went to a mule auction in his hometown there in South Carolina, and there was a mule there who was not a Cubs fan and kicked Bobo in the leg that was recovering, and so he had to wait a while longer. He was up in the majors, I think, pitching. I forget for what team it was, but he was pitching against the Cleveland Indians, I think, and one of the men on the team said, "Give me an outside pitch, Bobo, and I'll knock you down with it." So Bobo threw him an outside pitch, and he hit a line drive and cracked up Bobo's knee. Then the next year, on opening day, Bobo was pitching, and he was pitching for the Washington Senators, and there was one of the slow rollers down the third baseline, you know how those kind of go, and the way a third baseman comes in, and he'll just scoop it up with his bare hand and flick it real hard to first base to try to get the runner. Well, he did that. Bobo was there on the mound, and he was so mesmerized by his third baseman's fielding that he forgot to duck, and the throw hit him right in the behind the ear and broke his jaw. It just seemed like there's one problem on top of another for Bobo. Well, sometimes it seems like that in other situations. Like about 1090 to 1080 BC in Israel, it seemed like there was one trouble on top of another. There's a series of crises. There's a personal crisis, for example. In chapter 1, there's a woman shaking and sobbing near the entrance of the tabernacle. In chapter 2, there is an ecclesiastical crisis because there are clergy who are immoral and domineering and so on. And then in chapter 4, there's a theological crisis because there are elders of Israel who make the most outrageous assumptions about God, chapter 4, verse 3, and so on. And all of this maybe shouldn't surprise us because we're still within the historical period of the Judges, the wild, disruptive days of the Judges. What more can we expect? There's little room for optimism, it seems. Well, it raises a question then. Why do you not despair when living in the gray days of the kingdom of God? Well, I think our text gives us some answers to that. We don't despair because, first of all, because of where God begins. That's chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 10. Now, obviously, we're just touching kind of the high points, but we don't despair because of where God begins. Well, notice the setting and the trouble in the first five verses of the book there. This man Elkanah, who seems to be a reasonably pious Israelite, has two wives. And Hannah is the one he favors, that he loves Hannah, but she is barren. And he has another wife, Peninnah. Did he marry her because Hannah was barren and he wanted to have children? Don't know. Text doesn't say. But anyway, anytime you have these multiple marriages in the Bible, there's always smoke and fire and trouble. Whenever they would go up to Shiloh, they're in the middle of Israel. They might go up to worship there, and they would be, Elkanah might be distributing the portion of the peace offering that's for the worshipers, and the portion of the meat and so on, and he would give to Peninnah and to her children their portions and so on. And Hannah, it's hard to say in verse 5 whether he gave her a double portion. Some think it was just a single portion. It's a hard thing for the translators and so on. But it shows he loved Hannah, but there's this friction. And the problem was that Peninnah aggravated Hannah. He tried to put her over the edge, irritated her. For some reason, Peninnah was a mouthy, fertile female who just delighted in digging Hannah. You can imagine what it must have been like. Peninnah's children would say something like, "We have a family here, but Hannah doesn't have any children." And Peninnah would say, "Oh no, Hannah doesn't have any children. Hannah, you probably want children, don't you? You probably wish you were as fertile as I am, don't you?" And so, well, all sorts of digs, but just to push her over the edge, and so she wouldn't eat, she wouldn't drink, and so on. It was miserable year after year. This is where God begins. We've been there before, haven't we? This is a pattern in the Bible. You go back and you have the pattern of the childless woman, right? You've got Sarah, right, in Genesis 11 to 21. Who finally had Isaac. Then you had Rebekah, Genesis 25, who went to 20 years of marriage before she and Isaac even had children. And then you had Rachel in Genesis 29 and 30, and she couldn't have children until she finally had Joseph. And then you go on and you come to Samson's mother in Judges 13, and she was barren and didn't have any children until she had Samson. And then you come into the book of Ruth, and Ruth is married for 10 years to one of Naomi's sons, but never had a child. So when she marries Boaz, the widow Ruth marries Boaz, there's no telling whether she'll have a child or not. But then she finally has Obed and so on. So this is a pattern, isn't it? And now it's Hannah, and she can't have children. Yahweh had closed her womb, it says. This is where God begins. He has a tendency to begin his work in nothingness, in utter human helplessness. That's where he seems to start. Now, what does he do here? How does this work out? Well, you might say it's a rough providence in a way that he exercises. It's as if the constant nasty digs of this mouthy Peninnah drive Hannah to desperate prayer, verses 10 and 11. If Peninnah wasn't doing that, would Hannah have been driven to that kind of desperate prayer? Oh, no. I don't know. We're just assuming. But it seems that in the text, it was that nasty, vicious haranguing of Hannah that drove Hannah to prayer. So you might say, oh, we owe it all to Peninnah then. Samuel's birth and so on. No, no. But that might have been what the Lord used as a rough providence to drive Hannah to that prayer. J.C. Ryle, who was a 19th century Anglican, by the way, I didn't check out the book table very well, but J.C. Ryle wrote, you know, Expository Thoughts on the Gospels, 7 volumes, marvelous stuff. You should get a set. I think they're still in print, etc., end of commercial. J.C. Ryle was about 25 years old. He was a Christian, and he was working in his father's bank. He had a fairly comfortable situation. He might have been headed to Parliament eventually, but then his father's bank went belly up. Some poor decisions were made. J.C. Ryle, at 25 years old, had nothing. He and a sister were taken in by a couple of friends of their family, but he had nothing. He looked back at that time, and he went into the ministry, not because he wanted to, but because that was the only way at that point that he could make a living. And so on. Ryle looked back at this later and he said, you know, if I had not been ruined, those were his words, if I had not been ruined, I would have never preached a sermon, I would have never written a book, I would have never written a tract, etc. If I had not been ruined, none of that would have happened. It was a rough providence. Sometimes the Lord uses rough providences. Now notice, when Hannah's driven to prayer, what her prayer assumes. You see that in verse 11. Yahweh of hosts, if you will surely look upon the affliction of your maidservant and shall remember me and not forget your maidservant and give your maidservant a male seed, I'll give him to Yahweh all the days of his life. Did you notice her words? If you will look upon the affliction of your maidservant. That's the very kind of language that's used in Exodus 3:7 when the Lord tells Moses, I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt. And now Hannah takes up that same kind of expression, if you will look, if you will see the affliction of your maidservant. She assumes that the Exodus God of Exodus 3, who cares for his whole people, also cares for individual servants, and that the broken heart of a relatively obscure woman in the hill country of Ephraim matters to him. And she's assuming that. But this is where God begins, in barrenness and helplessness. It was back in about 1740, Samuel Blair made a reflection on religion in the American colonies. Now, there were some rumblings of an awakening and so on, but apparently it hadn't become very widespread and so on. But this was Samuel Blair's reflection on the state of spirituality and religion in the American colonies at that time. He said, religion lay, as it were, a dying and ready to expire its last breath of life in this part of the visible church. Pretty bleak. And then there was the great awakening. You see where God begins. He begins in helplessness. We can put it in terms of a principle. Your helplessness tempts God's omnipotence. So we don't lose heart because of where God begins. Now, number two, secondly, we don't lose heart because of how God works. Chapter 2, verse 11 through chapter 4, verse 1. So if we can look at that part of the text. Now, what makes the darkness so dark in Israel at this time? Well, the state of religion and worship at the tabernacle in Shiloh, partly. There were two problems. One was perversity, and another was laxity. Look at the perversity first in chapter 2, especially verse 12, just the general statement. The sons of Eli were wicked scoundrels. They did not know Yahweh. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't know about Yahweh, that they didn't know about the Lord. They did. It says they didn't know Yahweh. He didn't make any difference to them. They didn't acknowledge him. That's a terrible thing to say about the clergy, isn't it? And these guys were the head honkers there at the tabernacle. Oh, that's in general. But then a particular element of perversity is the liturgical problem. You notice there in verses 13 to 17, really. And it depends. Some scholars think there was just one offense mainly. Others think there was a double offense. I tend to think there were two, and that the writer is giving us a sample of both of them. On the one hand, when someone was offering a sacrifice, the priest servant, now the priest was accorded the breast and the right thigh of a sacrifice and so on, but it looks like in verse 12 and 14, or 13 and 14 rather, 13 and 14, that maybe the priest servant would come by and take a little bit more than what he was allotted. He takes part of the worshiper's portion. He just stuck his big barbecue fork down in there, and whatever it brought up, he took away. And then verse 15 seems to indicate a more severe problem. It says, before they burned the fat. Now, the fat of the sacrifice was to be burned on the altar and was to be burned in honor of Yahweh and so on. But before that even took place, before they even had the reverence to let that happen, the priest would send somebody by and threaten the worshiper and said, look, the priest doesn't want any cooked meat. He wants raw meat. He wants fresh meat. And if a worshiper said, let the Lord's portion be burnt first, he would say, no, don't give me that. You either give it or I'll take it by force. So Eli or Hophni and Phinehas thugs would come by and do that with worshipers. Now, you can imagine how aggravated people would be with the contempt that Eli's sons showed for the worship and the sacrifice of God. Of course, then there's a whole matter of laxity, and you see that in verses 22 and following. The Hophni and Phinehas were immoral. They would shack up with the women who were doing janitorial work at the tabernacle. And people in Israel knew it was happening and so on. So their father Eli would try to reason with them a bit and rebuke them and said, you know, we hear about all this. It's not good, fellas. You shouldn't be doing this at all. He kind of just slapped their hands a little bit. Now, Hophni and Phinehas were too old to spank. But they didn't need to be serving as priests if they're shacking up with the women at the tabernacle. Eli should have dismissed them as priests. He should have kicked them out of the priest's office, but he didn't do it. And later, leader, God calls that honoring your sons more than me. You know, you can get into grave sin by thinking that it's important to be tolerant. Gotta watch that. That was Eli's problem. So what a bleak picture you have here of organized religion. How dark the darkness seems to be. Now, sometimes, though, there are hints of hope in the dark, aren't there? I want you to notice as you look at this section, chapter 2, verse 11 and following, that there are these little sandwiched Samuel notes in there. Most of them are one-liners. You see, chapter 2, verse 11, after Samuel was left as a small lad up at Shiloh under Eli's superintendence, the lad was serving Yahweh in the presence of Eli the priest. Then you have all these offenses of Hophni and Phinehas and so on. And then you get down to verse 18. Now Samuel was serving before Yahweh, a lad clothed with a linen ephod. Talks about the care that his mother took in bringing him a new robe every year. And then the last of verse 21, now the lad Samuel grew in Yahweh's presence. And then Eli rebukes his sons, and they don't listen to him. And in verse 26, now the lad Samuel went on growing and having favor both with Yahweh and with men. And then you have a prophecy against Eli and his house and so on. And in chapter 3, verse 1, now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli. You think, see what's going on there? You have this blatant offense in the worship and in the house of the Lord and so on, that these moral scumbags, Hophni and Phinehas, are perpetrating. But then you have these little Samuel notes. Don't forget, Samuel's serving there. Samuel's growing. He's serving in Yahweh's presence. Don't forget Samuel. It's just little slivers, one-liners put in there as if a little hint. Because God is not doing something obvious does not mean he's doing nothing. Richard Buse quotes Matthew Henry, and I don't know exactly where he got it from Matthew Henry, but Matthew Henry said, "The God of Israel, the Savior, is sometimes a God that hides himself, but never a God who is absent. Sometimes in the dark, but never at a distance." And you see God working quietly. Here's Samuel. Don't forget Samuel, etc. Even in this bleak and vicious sort of situation in among the people of God. You can sometimes, you know, assume that because God worked quietly, he's not working, and sometimes you can misinterpret silence. There was a time when Samuel Wesley and Susanna Wesley, the parents of the famous, more famous John and Charles Wesley, well, Samuel and Susanna had their first child, and they named him Sammy. And they were hoping that he would become like his father, an Anglican minister, and so on. But he never talked, and so on. And he didn't talk. They assumed by the time he was four, he was not talking, and they assumed he was a deaf mute. And their hopes of seeing him in the ministry, of course, were dashed. Well, there was one day when Susanna was worried because she couldn't find Sammy. And she went through the house looking for him, couldn't find him. She went outside looking for him, couldn't find him. And even though she was sure he couldn't hear, because he was a deaf mute, she was sure he couldn't hear. But you know how it is when you're in a panic and so on, you cry out for child and so on. And she was calling his name. And finally, she heard a voice said, "Here I am, Mama." And she looked under a table, and there was Sammy holding his favorite cat. And from that point on, he talked just like the other children did. Now, it's easy to misinterpret silence. And sometimes it's easy to think when God's working in a secret way that he's not working. But you see what he's doing here. In his quiet, secret way, God is beginning to prepare for new godly leadership, even in the midst of the present raunchiness, but you won't see it much unless you really pay attention to this little lad Samuel there. So God silently provides for the next moment. Even in the midst of darkest moments, he's not in a panic. He's going to grow what his people need for leadership. And of course, you may want something more blatant. We'd love to have something more obvious, something more tangible. Now, sometimes the subtle is just as effective, isn't it? There's that story. You've probably heard it before. About the bombing crew in Second World War were in a B-17, and they made their bombing run, and they were hit by Nazi anti-aircraft flak, so on. Not only were they hit, but their gas tanks were hit, but they weren't blown out of the sky. They got back safely from their bombing run, and the next day the pilot went down to the armorers and said he wanted to get the shell that was in their gas tank as a souvenir, kind of a good luck souvenir, I guess. You know, we got hit, but somehow it didn't explode. He wanted the shell. Well, the armorer said, well, there wasn't just one shell. There were 11 shells in your gas tanks. And they got back safely. So they said intelligence came by and picked up the shells. So pilot went to intelligence and so on, and he found out the rest of the story. Well, all those shells had no charge in them. They were empty. No explosive charge, all except one. It was a wrapped up little note scrawled in Czech. Well, you have to find a translator somewhere on the base that knows Czech, so they found one. And it said, "This is all we can do for you now." What'd that mean? Well, that means, you see, that there were Czech fellows who were forced to work in a Nazi munitions plant. Now, they didn't have the wherewithal to form a conspiracy to assassinate Hitler. They didn't think they could blow up the munitions plant, but they could just kind of forget to put charges in some of the shells they were making. It was very quiet, unobtrusive. But for some people, it was very effective. This is all we can do for you now. And sometimes that's the way God works. He works secretly and silently and subtly and subversively. And it's likely that a good bit of God's work, even in your own congregation or congregations, is of that ilk. There's a lot that goes on that God is at work doing quietly that may not be obvious to many of you. So we don't lose heart because of the way God works. So where God begins, how God works. Thirdly, we don't lose heart because of what God reveals. Chapters 4 through 6, if you would turn there, we'll try to summarize that. Because of what God reveals. So, in chapter 4, you hear the abysmal theology of the elders of Israel. Israel went out and they fought against the Philistines, and the Philistines bested them. Israel came back into the camp, and they said, "Why'd we lose against the Philistines, etc.?" So the elders have this great idea. They say, "Let us bring," chapter 4, verse 3, Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. That's sort of a bit of superstition rather than faith. If we have the Ark of the Covenant, you remember, was, talk a little bit about this maybe tomorrow, that sacred box and so on that had the Ten Commandments in it, and it was in the inner compartment of the tabernacle, and it represented God's very presence among his people and so on. So he said, no, what we need is have the Ark of the Covenant come and let it go with us into battle. And then it, well, actually, let it save us. Their thinking seems to be, if we have God's ark, we're going to have God's help. If we have God's furniture, we're going to have God's power. It's not faith, it's superstition. If we have this, boy, see, if the Ark of the Covenant would be captured, that would bring shame on Yahweh's name, wouldn't it? That would be a blotch on his reputation. He's got to give us victory, otherwise it wouldn't look good for him. So we've got the pressure on. There's a story about John Quincy Adams, the sixth president, and there's some debate about whether the story is actually true or not, or whether, you know, you never know about some of those things. But the story goes this way, that John Quincy Adams was quite a swimmer. He was a very adept swimmer. And he liked to go off from the White House and get down near the Potomac very, very early in the morning. And he'd strip, and he would go in for a swim in the Potomac, so on. Now, there was one morning when he did that, dumped his clothes and so on, plunged in and so on, and then a few minutes later, as a female voice that said, "Come here." It was Ann Royal, who was a female journalist, and she said, "Look, I'm sitting on your clothes, and I want an answer from you on the state bank question. I've gone everywhere trying to get answers. I beat on the doors of the White House. I've been turned away. Everybody stonewalls me. But I've been stalking you, and now I'm sitting on your clothes, and you're not getting out of there until you give me an answer." That's what you call pressure. Now, that's the sort of thing that the elders of Israel seem to be thinking. If we have the Ark of the Covenant, Yahweh's going to have to come through to deliver us from the Philistines. Well, problem was, he didn't do that. The Philistines, they were horrified. They heard the shouting when the Ark of the Covenant came into Israel's camp, and they were trembling and so on and afraid. And finally they said, "You know, you fellows, you just need to buck up yourself, pull your pants up, bite off a chunk of red man, and go in and fight like men. Do the best you can." And they did, and they won. And they captured the ark. And in the process, chapter 4, verse 11, Hophni and Phinehas died in that battle. So God's judgment came down on Hophni and Phinehas. But the problem here is Israel's thinking, isn't it? So God let his ark be captured. And you see that in the first part, right, of chapter 5. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. Now you get the idea, and the media knows how to interpret that. What do you do? Well, the Ark of the Covenant isn't an image of God, but it does represent his presence. So when it was taken captive, they bring it, the Ark, the paraphernalia of the defeated God, get it, into the presence and chapel of the victorious God Dagon, and they put it beside him. Praise Dagon, from whom all blessings flow. So there's the way the media would interpret it at that time. And the Lord is showing Israel that he would rather suffer shame than allow them to carry on a false relationship with him. So their superstition and their pressure didn't work. Now, so how does God reveal himself here? Well, he reveals his countermeasures, and he does so humorously on the one hand, because the next day, chapter 5, verse 3, the people in Ashdod come in, and whoa, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of Yahweh. Yeah, it's as if he's doing homage to Yahweh. He's the victorious God, but he's doing homage to Yahweh, as it were. Well, then you have these hilarious words, verse 3. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. Now, an Israelite writer would just be laughing up his sleeve as he wrote that. I know it doesn't tickle you, but it would tickle an Israelite. Look at how ridiculous that is, he would say. Indeed, you have to understand, too, that in the ancient Near East, devotees took very good care of the images of their gods. I don't know about all the Philistines. I suppose it would have been similar. But some of the Mesopotamian and Egyptian situations, the image of the god wasn't thought to necessarily be identified with the god, but was thought to be the presence of the god was thought to be in the image. Now, that wasn't automatic. See, there had to be something called an opening of the mouth ceremony that they did for the image that kind of brought the presence of the god into the image. It's sort of like when you get a new credit card and it says on there, call 1-800-da-da-da-da-da to activate your card. You make the call, and then it's activated. Well, the image has to be activated. It has to have the presence, because they have this opening of the mouth ceremony, and then they would feed the image, or the god in the image would have two meals a day, oftentimes, and they would play music, the curtains would be drawn, meat and then fruit would be brought in before the image, they would wash the image, there'd be time for the consuming of the food and so on, and nourishment, and then after that they would wash up the image, and of course the food was still there. And I guess they thought the deity inhaled or something. But it would be carted off then to priests or someone else and so on. But there was this very elaborate kind of pattern in which they took quite good care of the images of their deities. And it's rather humorous here, because Dagon's down on his face before the ark. It gets even worse, of course, as you know, because the next day after that, you can only fall so many times without cracking up, and that's what happened then, the next day. And then the head of Dagon and his hands and so on were cut off and so on. And they didn't have any super glue to take care of it. So you might say that the Lord made his point here humorously. Now, if you're really glum and you don't think there's any humor in the Bible, I feel sorry for you, because you'll find it oftentimes. But when there's humor in the Bible, it's always because a serious point is being made. And it's being made here. God shows his adequacy humorously, his supremacy in a humorous way, and then he does it fearfully, doesn't he? Not only is Dagon getting the godness knocked out of him, but after this in Ashdod and then in Gath and then in Ekron, the ark keeps moving along as they shuffle it away. A plague takes place among the Philistines. tumors and so on. And apparently it's lethal for some. It causes some death and so on. And they don't know what to do. So they take it away from Ashdod and they take it to Gath. And the same thing happens in Gath. And people are dying. And so on, these tumors and this plague. And some scholars think that maybe it was the bubonic plague because the mention of mice or rats and so on may have been carriers. We don't know for sure. But God was bringing judgment on the Philistines. They take it then to Ekron, and the junior chamber of commerce at Ekron said, no, you're not bringing that thing in here. We've got to send it back to Israel. But you see, God then shows not only his supremacy humorously, but fearfully. And the point is, Dagon can't protect his devotees from this. Yahweh is besting his people, and he can't defend them. And if he was a God who had any godness in him, he ought to be able to do that. But then Yahweh shows his supremacy and his reality irrefutably. You drift into chapter 6. Now, I'm not going to read it and so on, but what happens in chapter 6, they find us like, we've got to get this ark back to Israel. Can't stay here. Too dangerous. And so they ask their religious gurus what they should do. And they say, well, you got to send it back with a gift. There were five main Philistine cities, so you have to send back five images, golden images of your tumors. That would be an interesting thing. Images of the mice or rats that have been ravaging the land, and you put those with the ark and put it on a cart, send it back. Now, to pull the ark, you get two cows that have recently had calves, and have never been harnessed or used for this, pulling a cart or anything before, and you hook them up to the cart, and you watch. You shut up their calves in a shed back there, and you watch and you see what happens. If those cows pull that cart and go straight to Israel, then we know Yahweh did this to us. But if they don't, then it just happened. Now you see how they stack the deck. Because the last thing in the world those cows are going to do, if their calves are shut up, is to go off on their own and to go pulling that cart to Israel. The first thing they're going to do is want to go back to their calves. And they apparently did, because they went on the road to Israel bellowing and lowing in protest. But they went and took the cart to Israel. Even a Philistine ought to be able to see what that meant. This is Yahweh's doing. Well, that's what Yahweh reveals. Well, that's what Yahweh revealed to the Philistines. What does it reveal to us, this little episode in the temple of Dagon and so on? Don't you see? Yahweh brought back his ark all by himself. He didn't need an Israelite army to stick him back on a shelf. He can handle his own difficulties. Now, that's hard for people in ancient Near East to get a handle on, in a way, because in a sense in which in ancient Near Eastern paganism, the idea was that the gods were dependent on man. There are some pagan flood stories that we have, you know, like the biblical flood story, but there are also pagan flood stories and so on. And one of them, in part, talks about a fella who is kind of the Noah-like figure, Utnapishtim, and talks about the time after the flood that Utnapishtim offered a sacrifice. And it says, and the gods gathered like flies over the sacrifice. Now, why was that? Well, you see, there was a flood. And the fish team and others weren't sacrificing. And if you don't get sacrifices, and if you're deities, you begin to lose energy, you know. and so on. So when the sacrifice began to be offered after the flood, the gods gathered like flies over it, because that's the way they get their nourishment, as it were. That's the way paganism is. The gods are dependent on man. In biblical religion, God supplies man. You never need to realize the revolutionary statement in Genesis 1:29, when God says, "To you they shall be for food." My, a God who sustains man, not the reverse. So you see what this is saying. This is good news. It's saying God doesn't need us. We don't have to prop him up. He's not some helpless mascot and so on. Remember the God, what God says in Isaiah 46, verses 3 and 4, when he's speaking about his people, ones who've been loaded up from birth, carried from the womb, all the way to old age, I am he, and to gray hairs, I will shoulder you. I have made, and I will carry. Yes, I will shoulder and deliver. Sometimes we need to have a shot of that to see the sufficiency of God. And it's really good news that he doesn't need us. And sometimes we need to watch ourselves when we hear little ditties like, "He has no hands but our hands and no feet but our feet to do his work." I know what they're trying to get at, and they're trying to catch up a bit of a biblical truth. But it's really a good bit of rubbish. So it's really stressing the sufficiency of Yahweh, isn't it, here? That's what it reveals. There's a story that's told, you know, I think Ronald Reagan used to tell it, of the fellow that, there's an accident in the street, and the victim was lying there, bystanders were around, and there was an elderly fellow bending over the victim trying to help, and another man elbowed his way through the crowd and got people aside and got up there, and he said, let me at him, I have first aid training. And he shoved the elderly gentleman aside, and he got down there and he started going through his steps of first aid and all that he knew. Well, this went on for a little while, and then the elderly fellow tapped him on the shoulder, and he said, "When it gets to that part where it says, 'Call the doctor,' I'm right here." Sometimes we can think it so depends on us, we forget the whole sufficiency of God. So don't be so feverish. It's not as if God is perplexed, wondering when the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America will finally get its act together. It's not like he's wringing his hands, wondering when Southside RP Church will actually get their vision together or something. Don't be so feverish. No, even in the gray days, we're buoyed up with confidence because Yahweh's preference is frequently to begin his work in the bleakest of circumstances, and because God's work is often done undercover and secretly, and because when we're thinking straight, we realize that Yahweh is perfectly capable of taking care of his own kingdom. Let's pray. Thanks be to you, O God, for the matchless gift of the Scriptures, and thank you for displaying yourself in them. And we acknowledge that the gray days in your kingdom don't seem quite so dark when we see you in the midst of them. And we pray that you would enable us to be faithful in our days until the day when the Son of Righteousness shines upon us at his coming. We pray it in Jesus, the King's name. Amen.